Hello and welcome to Monocle on Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now today, since it's Oscars week, we're talking about one of the big award nominees, and we should say that we recorded this pre-Oscar results, so it could even potentially be a winner today. It's already won BAFTAs, a Golden Globe and the Palme d'Or at Cannes. The film is Parasite, the black comedy by director Bong Joon-ho, which explores class divide in South Korea as a brother and sister from the impoverished but, as you very quickly discover, very savvy Kim family become tutors for the wealthy Parks, a handsome couple with two kids who live in a large modernist house in the nice part of town. As the two families become intertwined, the film turns darker as societal structures take hold, making things difficult for the Kims, who are constantly trying to infiltrate the Parks in order to get out of their dilapidated semi-basement flat. It's a stylish film and very funny too, and it was nominated for 6 Academy Awards, and deservedly so. But why is this the Korean film that's got all the critics' tongues wagging? Well, to find out today, I'm joined by Simran Hans from The Observer New Review and Tim Roby from The Daily Telegraph. Welcome both to the programme. Lovely to have you here. And in service to a movie that, no spoiler required, I know you both greatly enjoyed. Tim, you brought this film to our attention at the end of last year. I know it obviously won the Palme d'Or in Cannes in the middle of the summer. And you were kind of brimming with its qualities when you came in to give us, I think, a review of last year rather than a preview of this one. Can you shine a bit of light on the director, Bong Joon-ho? Is this his normal kind of world?
I was over the moon when it won the Palme d'Or, because that's where I'd seen it in Cannes. And I couldn't really think of a more entertaining winner recently, which was also so sophisticated and clever and would be such a satisfying film for audiences to discover. I think it's a career peak for him, I would say. But he has built up a very interesting career, half a dozen or so films. He's become a bit of a cult favourite over the years. In fact, so much so he has this Twitter fan base called the Bong Hive, hashtag Bong Hive. And they were obviously delighted by his win as well. The first of his films I remember seeing was one called Memories of Murder, which is about probably 15 years ago, which is a very clever police procedural in which the cops investigating this serial killer in Seoul. Yeah, but they're kind of bumbling the police through half of this film. It's sort of a comedy, and then it switches into a really dark drama, and he does these swerves. I think that's what people have noticed about him. Is that he can switch tones in the space of a scene from kind of horror to farce. And a lot of the time in this film, that's what he is doing. You start out, as you sort of said, with a kind of black comic satirical idea, but then it does go quite horrific at times. There are hilarious sequences as well. And he manages to keep a hold on that tone all the way through, which I think is the real skill of it, without too many obvious lurches.
Yeah, it's quite a genre-shattering film in many respects. You never quite know what you're watching. Simran, how would you... Let's not put it into a pigeonhole. Let's put it into a beautiful, spooky, modernist house. What sort of house is it? Because it does, it jumps between many stools, doesn't it, this film?
Yeah, so the film takes place primarily in two locations. You have the Kim's house, which is a sort of subterranean apartment, and then you have the Park house, which is this crazy... And, you know, for the film, they built the house from scratch. But it's a crazy kind of multi-layered, modernist marvel, sort of wide glass walls and wood panels and angular sort of sloping roofs. And it's a really visually interesting and dynamic place for them to shoot in. And there's a point in the film, and I guess we'll get to this when we sort of talk about the structure of it, where it sort of turns into a thriller and a kind of cat and mouse chase. And there's lots of interesting, weird crevices for people to sort of, you know, lurk behind or hide in or crouch under. We can get into that more. But the house itself is crazy. It's crazy.
And is this... So we'll come on to the house kind of as a character as well. We'll go through some of the characters and things. We'll maybe end up with the house as a character in its own right, because it certainly has a lot of... holds a lot of sway over the possibilities of the drama of the film. Most of the drama takes place within the house itself. But what are we looking at here? Is this, as you say, this is about a poor family, a very poor family, insinuating their life profitably into the house and life of a wealthy family, often by doing over, not necessarily killing them, but getting their kind of their pre-replacement sacked. Are we reading this as a parable? I mean, there's a lot of... it's been read as a sort of statement on Korean society, on various different things. Let's not forget that the action starts with the son of the poor family, the Kims, coming in as a private tutor to the daughter of the wealthy family. Korean education is a terrifying edifice of perfection. So there's a comment there. But what is this? This seems like a Trojan horse. It seems like a Greek myth. It seems like a parable. What actually is it to you two, Tim?
There's a bit of a Trojan horse thing, yeah. And it also reminds me a bit of films where a mysterious stranger inveigles his way into a household and manages to kind of get one up on everyone one by one.
Dickie Greenleaf.
Yeah, or like The Servant, or like Pasolini's Theorem with Terence Stamp, for instance. In fact, it reminded me a bit of going to see a ballet production of The Servant that Matthew Bourne did a few years ago, in which multiple actors played the main roles and moved around the space of the house, and you could see all of these clever manipulations and seductions going on. And I think there's a certain ballet-like element to this film. The choreography of it in some of the big sequences is very dance-like and meticulously choreographed. But then underneath that, there is a really serious seam of kind of satirical commentary, I think, because the more that the poor family do to try and stake a claim over this house and to kind of grab a dominant position, the more social structures fall away from underneath them and leave them in an even worse position than when they started. And that's really what he's going for at the jugular at the end, really, is this idea that, you know, they can strive and strive and strive, but then they're always going to end up at the bottom of the heap. And what happens to them in the later stages of the film is kind of terrible and disastrous and involves their entire house being inundated and all kinds of things. And I really like that because it kind of comes at you and you're not really expecting for it to happen that way, I think, in this film. It comes out of the blue.
Yeah, so we've got the idea of servants, we've got a patriarchal society, we've got Korean education and aspiration, very much, Simran. Are these the things that we, for you were kind of either front and centre or simmering somewhere in that house?
I mean, for me, I think if you sort of boil down this film to its essence, it's about class and it's about this sort of fundamental idea of whether you can ever truly have social mobility. And I think it's a critique of that idea. And the film is very clever because it kind of goads you into a sort of false sense of security and kind of lets you live out any preconceptions that you might have that, yes, actually, it is possible through education, through money, through opportunity to transcend the status into which you were born. And so for the first kind of, I don't know, maybe 40 minutes of the film, it's very enjoyable because we're aligned with the perspective of the Kims, who come from nothing, but they have each other. They have a sort of supportive family structure. They have a laugh. They're able to kind of get one up on this family who are sort of snooty and rich and privileged and have no perspective. There's a brilliant kind of subplot with the daughter, Ki Jung, who comes in to be the art therapist to the younger son, Da Song, of the Park family. And she's just Googling it and making it up. It's a real send-up of kind of middle-class parenting and the sort of cringeworthy things that people pay for. And so we get kind of, yeah, lulled into this really delicious sense of revenge beginning to build and happen. And then something really interesting happens and you realise that, you know, perhaps this manipulation isn't quite as successful as we thought it was. And watching that drama, kind of the bricks sort of build and then topple, is so satisfying.
There's some proper suspense in this film as well. There's a scene kind of halfway through the film when the Parks go out for a camping trip for the son's birthday. The Kim family are now completely insinuated in the house and kind of get drunk and have a little kind of party. Halfway between an argument and a party anyway, but they get drunk and slightly trash the sitting room. And you just know that that perhaps is the point when things are going to turn. Now we might go back to the house and its character.
Well, there are secrets to be found in the basement of this house, as they discover.
Like all good.
Yes.
Genre hopping movies.
Like in, you know, Hitchcock's Notorious in the wine cellar or whatever. There's stuff down there that they haven't figured out. And what works so well with Bong's kind of class paradigm here is that the upper echelon of the house and its gleaming surfaces is everything that the Kim family want to get their hands on. But what they find in the basement is the grim horror of what they've... they're being dragged back down. down towards at all times, essentially, and their roots and their inability to escape that. And it's almost as if claws come up from the basement to drag them back down without explaining exactly how that happens. And I think that is brilliantly clever. And it arrives at exactly the moment in the film where we have achieved this full sense of security with them. Even though there are interesting sort of sympathy nuances with the other family and with the housekeeper, who they, you know, in some ways have to sort of throw over completely to establish their position. And what happens?
There's quite a lot of sort of servant on servant hatred.
It is, and there's kind of dog eat dog.
It's difficult to sort of take sides with any or against any of the people in the film, because no one acts with complete dignity throughout, do they?
I think that's what's so clever about the film, is that everybody is implicated, right? Anyone who thinks that they are above snobbery or sort of selfishness or, you know, judging another person gets kind of taught that lesson the hard way. And that's what makes it kind of so, juicy to watch.
There's a funny thing of the house being this pure machine for living, this sort of elegant machine for living that it is. Things get hidden away and snuck away in drawers, and everything's kind of hidden, all the pipework, anything that is to do with the controls to the house, the heating, everything is kind of hidden away in this sort of modernist place. Even it comes down to one of the ways that the Kims have done over the sort of former factotums in the house is an ingenious way of getting rid of the old driver by the daughter hiding her knickers under the seat and implying that this driver kind of has sex in the back of his car with whoever and whenever. And then they turn up again, and this kind of fetish for this, the husband and the wife, he says, you know, put these knickers on and then we'll kind of make love and it'll be a little bit more dirty than usual. There's a sort of another idea of things being hidden away, right? This fetish is like the pipes in the house. It's something not to be talked about.
There's an obsession with propriety that you get.
Exactly.
From everything down to the way that, you know, they want their fridge organised or whatever, and the kind of fruit that they get served and all these things. But then what enables Bong to kind of bring the comedy out is, of course, when the rich family reveal themselves to be kind of kinky as well. And one of the funniest lines, which I'm going to say because it is just so funny, is when the husband is kind of stroking his wife's breast, she says, no, do it clockwise. And it's just so hilarious.
It is. Notes on punctiliousness. Yeah. Do houses in films, these kind of beautiful modernist palaces, from James Bond villains' lairs to the house in North by Northwest, and there's a kind of list as well, the Lautner house and the Big Lebowski and all the rest of it. We know that nothing good comes of these places somehow. I don't think as cinema goers we're meant to trust the kind of steel and glass perfection of modernism in architecture. What is it about these places? I suppose for a director there are sight lines and all sorts of opportunities for eavesdropping in places that are essentially one big room. But what is it? Is there anything we can read into this, Simran, about that our sort of, we want something a little bit more like the house in Knives Out for our crimes to be committed in somehow, perhaps?
Well, I think there's something about technology and newness and, you know, maybe the idea of new money as well that is being explored here. It's not like the crazy mansion in Knives Out, which is a sort of historical, sort of almost like a castle, the way it's constructed. It sort of suggests legacy and old money. And this film, I think, kind of uses the modernist house to explore the idea that maybe people have inherited their wealth or come to it through sort of not through legacy but through work, and maybe that gives them a false sense of entitlement about it, and maybe you can read that into the way the house is used.
Yeah, I would say it's about wealth and modernism and corporate ways of acquiring wealth and the kind of gleaming wide open layouts of these places just seem to speak of all of those things. I was even thinking about it the other day, watching the documentary Edge of Democracy, which is another Oscar nominee, which is about the corrupt government practices in Brazil. The palace in that film where the president lives is exactly the same kind of place. As the camera glides through it, it's like something out of Kubrick's The Shining. You're like, there's definitely rot going on here somewhere, you know?
Yeah,
or evil hiding in plain sight.
Right.
In terms of the cinematography and the way the film is put together, the sort of gaze of the camera and all the rest of it, what sort of universe are we in there? Because I know that the director has called this a staircase film in certain ways. But, you know, that says to me Hitchcock and suspense and things like that.
There's definitely some Hitchcock in there. I think that Bong's visual style is often quite reminiscent of Spielberg as well, actually. And I think his ability to kind of speed up and slow down scenes with close-ups in exactly the right place, his general command of the space. He made a film called The Host, which is a monster movie about this giant thing attacking Saul, which is rather like Jaws. And his focus on the families in these films, again and again, reminds me of Spielbergian families as well. I think there's definite links between them, their films. I do think that the difference from Spielberg is the daring with these kind of unexpected shifts in tone. I think when you settle into a Spielberg film, you generally know what kind of film you're in for. They are of a piece. Whereas in Bong's films, you just don't know how many different weird avenues he's going to go down. And his satire Okja, for instance, about the meat industry, was off the wall and had sort of performances ranging from terrible Jake Gyllenhaal to, you know, some of the really inspired Asian actors in that film. Sometimes his films don't hang together, and I think Snowpiercer was another one for me which didn't quite work. But this one really does. It feels as though he's storyboarded it to perfection. And I love the middle section of the film, which, as you say, takes place over one night, because everything kind of slows down to this moment of them thinking they're on top of the pile, but then are they? And it's a beautifully extended set piece that's probably 45 minutes of screen time. And I think every aspect of it, right down to the master shot with no sound as the most extreme pylon in the film is happening, yeah, in the far distance. Just such a perfect little moment, just for a few seconds. It's almost like a tableau.
So let's talk about the characters finally.
I think the performances in this film are so amazing, and it's interesting, given the sort of Oscar talk around the movie, that it's transcended a lot of barriers. The fact that it's not in English but has been nominated for Best Film as well as Best Film not in the English language is, you know, really interesting. I think only maybe 11 or 12 films have been nominated for Best Picture that aren't in English, so it's significant. But it's a little bit of a shame to me that none of the actors have been nominated, although they did get kind of recognised as an ensemble cast at the SAG Awards. I just think some of these supporting performances are just as good as anything else I've seen this year. I particularly think that Park So-dam, who plays Ki-jung, who's the younger daughter of the Kims, I just think she's so funny and kind of biting and satirical. She is an interloper who takes best to the role of the scammer in the family. You know, all of them have a knack for it and are quite resourceful, but she's the one who it just comes to naturally. And it's such a pleasure sort of watching her, you know, rule the roost, really, and kind of slip into that role. I also think that Song Kang-ho's performance as Ki-taek, who's the Kim father, I just think there's so much pathos and kind of sadness and resilience in that role. And I think, you know, in an ideal world, he would be nominated for Best Actor.
Yeah, he's very subtle, isn't he? He's got quite a lot of work to do, and his dynamic with his whole family and his son, and having to go from being the sort of patriarch, the kind of down on his luck patriarch, to then having to be the driver for the wealthy for the Parks. He's got quite a lot of work to do, particularly, hasn't he?
He's the one who's the real veteran in this cast in terms of working with Bong before. He had one of the lead roles in Memories of Murder, for instance, all the way back then. And it's been great to see, because he has been sort of noticed here and there. He was in the supporting actor chat a little bit. He just didn't get a nomination, which he should have done. And I love Park So-dam. She's already a meme, isn't she, because of the kind of mnemonic kind of test that she does, a little jingle that she does outside the door when they're trying to remember exactly who she's pretending to be when she gets in. And it's, you'll find it on YouTube already. I also love the performance by the housekeeper, Lee Jong-un, who is a bit of a nuisance to begin with, and she has kind of notions. She sort of swans around slightly as if she owns the place, and you sort of feel as though she deserves her comeuppance. But then what happens to her is so brutal that you end up feeling rather sorry for her. But then she becomes kind of a nightmare again, and you just go back and forth with that character so much. I really enjoyed her, and I'll put in a last shout for the rich trophy wife, who I think is fantastic, Jo Young-yeon, who has a kind of real... she wants to see the best in everyone, and she's very easy to take advantage of, and she's very gullible. But you sort of feel protective towards her. You never feel as though she's the baddie at any point.
Yeah, and that's the subtlety in both the performances and the writing, right? That it makes you sort of be frustrated with them and want to kind of slap them around the face and get so annoyed with them. But then also you feel sorry for them, you feel empathy, you feel sympathy. And they're sort of really well-constructed antagonists and protagonists that are both kind of, yeah, sympathetic but flawed.
So that is Parasite. Simran and Tim, thank you very much indeed for your wit and wisdom on such a fine movie. This is the bit where we're going to turn our attention to what it kind of reminded you of, and in your reviewing, what you sort of turned to for like-minded souls. Tim, you've chosen Shoplifters. Tell us about this one.
So the really remarkable coincidence with this film is that it won the Palme d'Or 1 year before Parasite did. And I cannot think of two more structurally interesting and comparable films to have won the Palme d'Or back to back. Mm-hmm. Remarkable. In this film, a family unit in Tokyo who are sort of almost equally deprived have to live day to day off their wits by robbing convenience stores and so on. And we realise that the family unit is not quite what it seems as it goes along. Much as in Parasite, you know, this lot, the Kim family, are pretending not to be a family. They're pretending to be coming at this house from all these different walks of life. Instead, of course, they're clubbing together to kind of, get one over on the parks. In Shoplifters, it's kind of the opposite structure, but in a way that's making the same points. And it becomes a film in which they crumble, they suffer, they go through a lot of the same kind of deprivation. Twists in the tale arise, relationships don't turn out to be what they seem to be, someone gets buried under the house in an extraordinary way. There are so many parallels, it's kind of uncanny. You would almost suspect that Bong had it in mind when he made it, but that's not possible because he'd been working on Parasite for years. So it's just a strange and uncanny thing that happened, that two of these very established East Asian filmmakers who have really kind of quite hardcore fan bases in the art house scene managed to reach kind of peak level within a year of each other with films which essentially are advancing a very similar argument. In the case of Shoplifters, it's not doing it in a funny way. It has kind of light-hearted moments within a very melancholic whole, I would say. But it is a spellbinding film with, again, phenomenal performances across the whole cast. Especially loved Sakura Ando in this film as the kind of, I'll put finger marks around it, the mother figure in the film.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a film that everyone should, if they've enjoyed Parasite, should put this next on the list. It's available to rent on YouTube for £3.50 or whatever. And I think it deserves many of the same viewers that will be, warming to Parasite right now.
So this one won the Palme d'Or the year before, in 2018, I suppose. Did it have the same sort of recognition at other international awards, especially American awards, that Parasite has been getting?
I mean, it was nominated for Best Foreign Film at the Oscars, but it lost to Roma, because Roma last year had the Parasite kind of platform of being the one that got all the nominations and also had the Netflix money behind it to get it a Best Picture nomination and so on. And great though Roma is, my heart was with Shoplifters, I've got to say.
But there's like also slightly different films in terms of like the tone and everything. And Parasite, I can't stress enough, is truly a romp.
Oh, it's definitely
so
a romp, yeah.
Enjoyable. Not to say that Shoplifters isn't enjoyable in its own way, but I can see why maybe Parasite has had such massive crossover appeal.
Absolutely right, yeah. Shoplifters is not nearly as kind of broadly entertaining in its kind of remit, but it is. I just found that the story parallels are so sort of remarkable.
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
There's less of that kind of like in at least the East Asian cinema that we see here. There is a marked difference between the Japanese and the South Korean way of telling stories. There's a lot of South Korean cinema. I know that we see the stuff that's a bit more shocking and it makes more kind of headway and headlines and things. But there is a kind of notable a subtlety to that Japanese way of storytelling, perhaps, that is less. It's less funny. And it's certainly less kind of like grabbing you by the lapels, it seems. Is there anything in that, or is that just what we see here in the UK, in Europe, and in the US?
Yeah, I can kind of see the distinction you mean. And I think a lot of Japanese cinema that we see, you could align it in some ways with British films about what the working class, you know, with kind of the Ken Loaches, the Mike Lees, family stories, this tradition of the family story dating back to Ozu in Japanese cinema, and they take it very seriously, and it's done with real kind of nuance and detail.
And I guess more realism as well.
And more realism, exactly. Whereas the Koreans do like to kind of go all out with some sort of slightly more genre trappings, and they like to reach a wider and slightly more kind of multiplexy audience, I think, with their films. But what I love about Bong is that he's able to smuggle in a lot of the same points into that kind of genre format.
Okay, what better time to mention Simran's choice, which is none other than Robert McKee's Story, Substance, Structure, Style, and the Principles of Screenwriting. On today's form, I wonder whether I was going to be at the title out, but I managed it.
Well done.
This is a screenwriter's classic.
Yeah, so a friend of mine gave it to me a while ago, and he had read it many times and said, you know, I think you might get something out of it. And I just picked it up for the first time this year, and it's a really chunky instructional manual. It's a hefty boy. Hmm. And it's extremely detailed and forensic in how it breaks down the structure of the movies that we love. And it's quite interesting to sort of see everything that you think you know, and things that are really basic, you know, a sort of three-act structure, the way the sort of scenes are constructed, to see that broken down into this almost numerical way is really interesting. But after having read it, I now can't watch any film without applying these rules of storytelling to what I'm seeing. And one thing that I thought when I watched Parasite was how beautifully it maps onto a sort of Shakespearean five-act structure in terms of all the sort of dramatic high and low points, in the ways in which the antagonist represents things that the protagonist lacks. And it's almost too silly to sort of bring up because it sounds so basic, but I just thought kind of seeing Parasite through this lens of classical Hollywood screenwriting, and, you know, thinking about storytelling as the engine behind what makes a film really good, and a really tight, well-plotted, balanced script being the most kind of emotionally satisfying thing that you can kind of get from a movie, I just thought that Bong had really done that well. And I think when you watch Parasite, I think it's very fun and you get swept along for the ride. But if you were to sort of slow down and analyse it and kind of look at its construction, it is so tight. And that's what I thought when I watched it for the second time. When I first watched it, I was totally immersed in the thrill ride of the experience. And then when I watched it again, I thought, wow, this is amazing writing. This is so kind of, meticulously and beautifully structured and plotted.
Simran on Robert McKee's Story, Substance, Structure, Style, and the Principles of Screenwriting. Woe betide any screenwriters flabby plotting from now on.
Well, like Quentin Tarantino, who just lost Best Screenplay at the BAFTAs to Bong for this film, and who might well do the same at the Oscars, you never know.
Yes, fingers crossed.
Yeah, this had a lot. This was a much tighter, sexier machine than Once Upon in Hollywood. Thank you very much today to my guests, Simran Hans and Tim Roby. And thank you, of course, to my producer, Holly Fisher. We'll be back at the same time next week when we'll be leafing through the new novel by Emma Jane Unsworth called Adults. But until then, from me, Robert Bound, thank you very much for tuning in.